Welcome to the Martin Bailey Photography Podcast. It's March 12, 2014, and this is episode 411. To celebrate the release of my new Craft and Vision ebook, Striking Landscapes, today I sat down with my friend David Duchemin to talk about landscape photography, and as I thought might be the case, we went on to discuss running a business based on your passion for the work, and we also touched on shooting with mirrorless cameras, avoiding going on location with unnecessary preconceptions, and developing a style along the way. Towards the end of the conversation, our Skype connection got a little bit flaky, so I didn't get a chance to ask David to give you his website address, things like that. So just in case there's a tiny chance that you might not already know, you can find David over at davidduchemin.com. So that's D-U-C-E-M-I-N.com. And also check out David's incredible new Craft and Vision video podcast. You can get to that at craftandvision.com, and there's a podcast link. But I'll put links in the show notes for this week's episode as well. And I'll also include some links to my new book. So if you go to mbp.ac/411 for this episode, all of the links will be there. For now, though, let's jump in and start to listen to my conversation with David Duchemin. Okay, so I'm delighted to be joined today by my friend David Duchemin, and we're going to talk about landscape photography and a few related subjects. So welcome to the show, David.
Thank you, Martin. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. It's really nice to be talking with you again, and I'm looking forward to... We've really got a blank canvas here today. We're literally just going to talk on a number of areas of landscape photography, so I'm looking forward to getting into it.
Yeah, me too. Very much, very much. And by the way, congratulations on the release of your latest landscape book.
Yeah, thank you very much. And thank you guys, you know, over at Craft and Vision for making it happen, because there'd be no point in me writing it if there wasn't a team over there to accept it and to do all of the design and layout and everything. And you work so hard on all of that stuff. So,
well, it's our pleasure. Thank you.
So, you know, obviously, I realize that you, as I do to a degree, you work in a lot of different genres of photography. But you know, over the years, obviously, it's impossible to miss that you're a very accomplished landscape photographer, as well as all of the other stuff that you do. So I'm going to pick your brains a little bit, and then we'll just bat this back and forward. But how about we start? You know, say you've decided that you're going to go and photograph a certain location, and you drive up. You know, what are you going to be thinking as you approach, or as you actually get into the act of starting to shoot that location, actually, you know, make your photographs?
That's a good question. I almost always think exactly the same thing when I either arrive on location or start photographing, and it usually can be best summed up with, oh my God, what am I doing here? I'm going to screw this up. I haven't got the first idea what I'm going to do. And I usually begin my creative process in this state of, I have no idea what I'm doing. And it sounds very defeatist, and it sounds very like this guy has no idea what he's doing. But I've actually found over the years that is for me and my creative process absolutely the best place I can start. Because the other alternative, again, for my personality type, is I arrive and I think I know exactly what I'm doing. and I think that has always stood more in the way of me recognizing what a place truly is, because the expectations kind of, and it, for anyone that's heard me talk before, I'm very, this is one of those hobby horses I get on, you know, it's either this or vision. I mean, I only got a couple sermons and I preach them in 20 different ways, but you know, part of our vision is not, it's not about how we see, you know, with the eyes. It's not the physical act of seeing so much as the, it's about being perceptive. It's about how we perceive. And I think if you are receptive, if you go into a situation where possibilities are okay. I think in my mind, if I'm like, oh, maybe I'll do this, or what if I do that? But as long as it doesn't cross that threshold and go from being a what if to, oh, I'm definitely going to do this. Because every time I've gone into a place and thought, I'm definitely going to photograph this. You know, I have this amazing idea and I'm going to get there and there's going to be snow and I'm going to do this, and I get there and there's no snow. Or the fall colors are going to be all, and I'm going to photograph this, and it's going to, the color palette's going to be reds and orange, and I get there and everything's green and the colors haven't changed yet, and I have to, I have to go somewhere else for a week and camp until the colors do change. I think rolling with a very open, just holding your expectations very openly, so that when you do arrive, you're looking at possibilities instead of sort of definitives. Mm-hmm. I think that's very helpful. And I encountered an idea recently while I was reading some other things, an idea that comes from Zen Buddhism, and that is this idea, and you would probably be more familiar with the word, this idea of Shoshin, which is a beginner's mind. And one of the things I read about it is in the mind of the person who thinks he's an expert or a master, he's kind of got to the end. There are no further possibilities because he thinks he knows it all. Mm. In the mind of someone who's kind of embraced this idea of the beginner's mind, that doesn't mean you have to be a beginner, but anyone who has this kind of internal creative posture of humility and receptivity recognizes that you don't know everything, that there is room for possibility, that there is room to ask the question, what if, and to fail and to try. And so for me, I know this wasn't exactly what you were asking, but for me, it's very important when I start a process to at least allow myself the natural inclination to go, man, I have no idea what I'm doing here. Mm. I should just go to the nearest pub and have a pint. kind of receptivity to the possibility of failure actually allows me to more comfortably fail, because anyone that's done this for any amount of time knows that the more you fail and at least are open to learning from your failures, the closer you get to the true work, the stuff that's risky, the stuff that maybe you're afraid to do, the stuff that requires some new techniques that you haven't experimented. It gets us out of the cycles of repetition and gets us into our new work. So that's almost always the starting place for me. Mm. I don't do things like, a lot of people do Google image searches they look up, photographers' ephemera, and they know exactly where the sun's going, exactly what time, they know how many raindrops are coming down per minute and all this kind of stuff. And I'm just like, I just want to make pretty photographs, man. Mm. So I'm not, because I don't imagine, okay, the sun's coming down at this point, it's going to be here. I would rather show up and be surprised. Mm. And I think that being surprised, and not everyone works like this, I never want to give the impression that my way is the only way, but being surprised actually gives a new energy to my creativity. I'm thinking, oh my gosh, look at this, rather than oh man, that the sun came down, 3 degrees more to the right than I thought, and now I'm disappointed, and oh crap, I work better when I have that element of surprise.
Mm. That's really interesting in that, I have a bit of a section in my book that covers this, but it's kind of related to, I don't do the Google search thing for planning either. I think the way I put it in the book is that I don't want to plant seeds, because I don't want to get there with a head full of other people's images. I want to get there and be totally open to the location. And
right.
I find that that's the only way that I become more creative as well. If you turn up with preconceptions of what you want to shoot, then you'll almost certainly end up going away with a whole bunch of images that someone else has already showed you. So
that's a good point. Yeah, absolutely.
And so, I mean, I do use I use tools to find out where the sun's going to be so that I know which side of a valley to go to and things like that. But I think that apart from that, we're very similar in that, I mean, I turn up as well and I'm there thinking, okay, so you have to start once you're in the location. But it, for me, it's really important not to look at other people's images before I go. And I think I start the passage with obviously you need to know what's in a certain area. You need to get your initial impetus from finding out what is where. You can't just sort of jump in your car and drive aimlessly. But once you know where you want to,
well, you can. You actually, I mean, you can.
Well, yeah.
But I think that's a different conversation.
Yeah, that's not quite what I meant. You can do that, but if you go out with a, you know, you find your initial ideas of where you want to go from looking at imagery and hearing what's, you know, you're not going to jump in a boat and sail for 3 days across the Drake Passage if you don't know there's Antarctica down there. But once you get there, you really don't want to have a head full of other people's images. And I think the thing that I go on to is that I often get back and someone will say, oh yeah, that's a great place. Have you seen this photograph? And they'll send me a photo and I'll be kicking myself because I didn't get it. But I'm not kicking myself because I didn't come back with someone else's images. I'm kicking myself because I didn't see it while I was there. I wasn't creative enough to make something that blows my mind as much as the new photo someone's just showed me.
I think it's important, Martin, though, because a lot of people listening are going to recognize that thought and that feeling and think, oh, yeah, I've had the same thing. But the reality is you may come back and someone may show you a photograph and you think, oh, man, I didn't see that. But I think it's very important to realize we all have different visions and you cannot see everything. And it's very important. I would rather come back with 12 really great photographs of what I truly saw through my own eyes, what I truly experienced, and look at someone else's work and go, man, that must have been a great trip. I didn't see that, rather than I should have. Because I think then we beat ourselves up as though the expectation is you have to make a photograph of every possible thing that's out there. Mm. You don't. And nobody sees the photographs you don't make. And the ones you don't make are probably being made better by someone else who sees that place in their own way.
Right.
So I totally identify with the feeling, but I fight against it because it makes me feel less good about the work that I've done, as though my vision, the things I did see, are less valid than someone else. We're always going to see someone else's work and probably look at it with greater favor in some ways because, one, we didn't see it. So that image is taking us by surprise, and it's fresh and it's new and we haven't kind of slaved over it with the same angst. Mm. So there's not the emotional baggage.
Yeah.
But I really think it's important for people to understand this is part of the natural creative process. When you look at someone else's stuff to go, huh, you know, I love that. I adore that photograph. I didn't make that, but it's amazing. Mm. Does that mean I should have made that photograph?
Yeah.
Of course not. I was busy doing my own thing.
Yeah.
But if you miss the opportunity to learn from that, I think that's when you should kick yourself because you should look at it and go, wow, why didn't I see that? Is that even something I should have noticed? Why didn't I see it? Or at least recognize, you come a little closer to recognizing your own vision when you realize what it is not. Because I think a lot of people struggle with what is my vision. Well, knowing what your vision is not is as helpful to know.
Yeah, and that's really strongly related to what I'm saying. That you know that it's not necessarily that I'm kicking myself because I didn't come back with the photo. It's because I'm kicking myself for not having had the creativity in the field to see something similar. But you're right. I mean, I don't necessarily have to come back with the images that someone else has already shot. And the value to me is, I'm finding that, you know, the work that I do come back is much more me than, you know, and that's where our style comes from. If, you know, people ask a lot, how do I develop a style? And I think that one of the best ways to do it is to shoot from you and not to shoot from ideas that you, or preconceptions that you've already picked up from someone that's already been there.
Yeah. Absolutely. And in fact, one of the best ways to develop a style is to stop trying so damn hard to develop a style.
Yeah, it is.
You know, I mean, it's a little bit like the author C.S. Lewis said at one point. He said, anyone that searches for originality is in that search for originality not going to find it. But if they just get on with doing their work and they tell their work in the and I'm very heavily paraphrasing, but if they do their work in the way that is most authentic to themselves, they will find, looking back on that work, that they have, in his case, he's talking about originality, they will have created something original. And I think that's the same thing with us. Do the stuff that's authentic to you and do it consistently. Be intentional about your work. And when you look back on a body of work, someone will be saying, man, I love your style. And you're thinking, oh, wow, you're right. I have one and I didn't even notice. Because the point is not style. The point is photographing authentic work. And you look back and go, oh, son of a gun.
Yeah. And that's exactly what I think happens. And it all comes from shooting a lot and shooting from your heart and not trying to be something else. So I think we're kind of, the conversation is going the way I'd hoped. We're stumbling on things that I think the listeners are going to be able to connect with.
Well, that's good, because I'm just making it up as I go.
and that's, and stuff that's out why, of thin air. And that's why I love having you on the show, David. Okay, yeah, we're out in the field. We've got a bunch of gear strapped to our back as we approach. What does your kit bag look like these days?
Gosh, you know, it's changing so much, and a lot of it just, well, some of it has to do with technology that allows these changes. A lot of it is just, you know, I mean, I think we've talked before about the accident that I had a few years ago, and sort of just ongoing mobility issues that have forced me. I just can't not carry all of that stuff anymore, and it works out nicely. Even though in my kit I still have a D4, two D4S bodies, and a D800, and you know I've got a Hasselblad film body, but the two cameras now that I am enjoying shooting with the most are the Fuji XE1 and the new Leica M, the 24 megapixel full frame. Both of those cameras, you know, they're so light. Together they weigh less than my DSLR. Mm. And the batteries are lighter, and the optics are exceptional, especially when you use the Leica or the Zeiss glass, and both will take them. Mm. With one adapter you can put those onto the Fuji. The image quality is staggering. Mm. And because of my mobility issues, I mean, other people could throw all this heavy gear and walk for miles. I can walk further than I once could with all this heavy gear because I have the lighter stuff and I don't need much. I mean, also when you have slightly smaller gear, you don't need as heavy a tripod.
Yeah.
And you can, you know, you can carry an extra bottle of wine or something with you, but I'm going into the field with less and less now, but still a kit of filters and extra batteries and that stuff. But usually it's my Fuji, my Leica, and then sort of a selection of wide angle lenses, everything from like 15 millimeters to 85, 90 equivalent. And it's funny, unless I'm photographing like wildlife or whatever, I'm not usually bringing the longer stuff, even sort of 70 to 200 equivalent. Mm. I'm just not doing it anymore. Because the bulk of the work that I like in my own portfolio, if I go through and in Lightroom do a metadata search, 90% of the work that I really, that I most resonate with is sort of between 16 and 35 millimeters on a full frame. Mm. So even the size of the lens, and of course, you know, then you go photograph wildlife and you're carrying 600 millimeters or whatever, but the smaller stuff for me, now that the quality is as good as it is digitally, is a real boon.
Yeah, I know that you lean to the wider side. It's I shoot most of my work now that the 24-70 is for me a good lens. I'm using that more, but I still probably shoot most of my landscapes with 70-200. So it's cool that you're not going out that far and you're still producing incredible work. So it just goes to show that we all see and do things so differently. I love to get the wider shots, but I almost always end up going in closer.
I think that speaks to something important, and that is, I mean, a lot of people, especially people that come on, you know, you and I have done our fair share of workshops and tours, and people will come and they'll see what you're doing. Their big question is, you know, what lens should I use? Mm. And and of course you try to be very gracious because you understand the intent of their question, but it is such a meaningless question in the sense that unless you, it's like saying, what I want to cook a meal, what ingredients should I use? Well, unless I know what you want to cook and how you want it to taste, I have no idea. Mm. And I love the fact that, you know, you can look at my work and say, oh, that shot wide with the 16-35 millimeter and admire the work, get something out of it, but feel no pressure whatsoever that, oh, I should be shooting with a 70-200 or instead of my 70-200 with a wider lens. And I think learning from other people's styles, but being very sure of this is what I prefer. And I'll experiment all over the place. I'll do a landscape with a 300 millimeter, 600, I don't care. But the fact is ultimately what I like the most is that wide kind of, you know, stuff. And I'll look at your work and think, man, I'm never going to see that because I don't even have the lens, you know, but that's fine because it's, your work is just so distinctly you and my work is distinctly mine. And that I think is where the rewards start coming. And that's where I think especially if you're doing this, you know, seriously with intention of creating a body of work, or whether it's commercial or not. That I think is when it pays off, because a consistent body of work, something that has a visual cohesion instead of like being all over the place and looking a little bit like Galen Rao, a little bit like Art Wolf, a little bit like Martin Bailey, and throw some Ansel Adams in there for good measure. The work becomes, I mean, I say this in the nicest way, but it becomes a little schizophrenic. It's a little all over the map.
And I think that people do tend to, you know, you'll pick out a certain, not a style as such, you know, but you tend to, what's the word, gravitate towards the things that you find most pleasure in. And so, you know, if you, what you just said earlier is a really good way to for someone that's not quite at this point yet, to see what they're gravitating to, is to do an EXIF search. You know, go into Lightroom and just click on the lenses, and you can list all of your images by focal length or by lens, and just to sort of, you know, go in there and see what you're shooting with the most. And you know, and not just when I say this, I'm not really talking about you know, across your whole image, all of the images that you've got in your library. You want to have a certain area of your library that contains only your best work, or the things that that pleases you most, a portfolio and things like that. And so, you know, see what focal lengths or what lenses you're shooting the portfolio with, and that's going to point you to the you know, what sort of gear you're really gravitating towards.
Yeah, it's a good tool too. I think, you know, all of us fall into there's a very thin line between what is our creative groove and what becomes a creative rut. And I have often sort of looked at it, and if I'm feeling a little discouraged, like, you know, the work I'm doing is repeating itself, or it's not what I expect, I will do a similar search and ask myself, you know, is it the gear I'm using? Is it that I've just got too comfortable with, you know, for a long time I was shooting so much portraiture with an 85, and I got bored of it, and I couldn't figure out why my work wasn't pleasing me the same way. And I noticed all my work was being done with 85 at 1.2, very shallow depth field. And I challenged myself to see if another aesthetic didn't do it for me creatively. So I put my, at the time, I think it was like a 17-40 F4 on, and I started photographing not only much wider, but also much deeper, like F8, F5.6, which I know doesn't sound very deep to some people, but when you've been shooting tight portraits, 85 at 1.2 is extremely shallow. I mean, you can get one eyelash in, one eyelash out. So, but it was interesting, because finding that rut, that helped me identify it when I was sort of floundering and kind of trying to figure it out. And now I photograph almost all with the 17-40 or 16-35 focal length. And someone could say, well, you know, maybe you're in a rut now. But the thing is, I don't feel that I'm in a rut. I still love what I'm doing. I still love the results. I still don't feel like I'm really repeating myself. And I've got closer to my vision. So it's a very good, for a couple of reasons, a very good exercise to go in and sort of look and go, what am I truly using? And frankly, if you've got that 300 millimeter and you go through 2 years worth of work and you notice you've never used the thing, put it up on eBay, you know, get the cash and buy a piece of gear that you're going to use. Otherwise, it just becomes a very quickly obsolescing piece of dust collecting paraphernalia.
And I think that there's a lot for people to take from this as well, in that, you know, you do have to keep yourself fresh. You do have to keep yourself feeling happy about your work. I think also there's a difference between being happy about your work and becoming complacent. And obviously we never want to get to the point where we feel as though we've arrived. I mean, none of us are ever, if we're going to continue to improve and, you know, to actually be good at what we're doing, I don't think any of us are ever going to arrive and say, I'm here, I'm now the photographer. And you know, so there's a big difference between being happy with and sort of feeling as though you're in your groove, and just thinking that everything you do is going to be amazing, and you know, you're soon going to find that at the moment people think that they have become what they wanted to become, the rest of the world is just going to steam past you. And it's not that it matters about what the rest of the world is or does. It's just, but I think that there's certainly something there in and being happy with your with what you're currently working with, and being happy with the results without being, you know, starting to become complacent.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that's a really good point.
So let's see. So you're off out. You're using your mirrorless cameras. I know that I would love to be able to downsize to some of that stuff. And I think for example, my Iceland tours that I do, I could totally see me working with a mirrorless over there if I can get, you know, if I can get the right lenses. I mean, at the moment for me, there's not a bunch of mirrorless cameras with scaled down lenses and everything in my bag, just purely for financial reasons. I can't really afford at the moment to build two kits up or move from one to the other because I've got such an investment in my Canon gear.
Sure.
But part of the reason for that is because, of course, in my case, I'm doing a lot of, I know that you do this as well, probably a lot more intelligent than I do with renting and stuff. But, you know, because I do have the wildlife work going on as well, that really requires some gear that, you know, it's really fast frame rate, really snappy autofocus, all of that. And I think that the mirrorless are getting there for sure. But at the moment, still really lean towards being, you know, such capable cameras more for landscape and portraiture and that sort of work. So I can certainly see me doing my Iceland tours with this kind of kit, and I'll be so happy to be able to, you know, my bag consistently weighs 15 to 17 kilograms, and
yeah,
you know, and it does I've worked with it and I make it work for me, but you know, I'm not getting any younger either. I feel as though, you know, sometimes I'm thinking, oh, Jesus, I just wish this was so much lighter. So I can totally see me moving to that sort of setup in the next few years.
Yeah, and you know, Martin, I mean, technology is changing so fast. Mm. None of us really truly know. I mean, there may be just unbelievably good all of a sudden. I mean, even the stuff Fuji's doing right now, you know, their focus is getting better. Olympus's focus is crazy fast on their four-thirds cameras.
Yeah.
You know, it is getting to the point where I think at some point we're going to see sort of, I imagine it'll have to be a slightly larger mirrorless camera that is like crazy fast because there's no mirror getting in the way.
Right,
and,
right.
You know, and fast autofocus. I mean, I think the day is coming, but I think as it is all of the time, I think all of the sort of the pro gear needs are, they got to pay off their R&D by producing prosumer stuff, first, because that's the stuff that's going to sell by the, you know, the hundreds of thousands, as opposed to, you know, the pros that need the really, you know, the $7,000 lenses. I mean, how many of those do they sell?
Mm,
you
know? Yeah.
But I think it's coming.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, you know, obviously we're out in the field, we've photographed, you know, our passion is going to be fulfilled. We've got, you know, we've got a whole bunch of landscape images that we're printing, we're enjoying as a hobby or a pastime. But what if people want to take that to the next level and actually start to try to make a business out of landscape photography? And I know that I'm seeding this question. We're both doing very similar sort of things here. But for the listeners, do you think that there's a way to jump in and make landscape photography or nature photography a business in the current market?
Yeah, I do. I think there's a lot of doom and gloom right now. It is. There's always, you know, ups and downs to markets and financial situations, and but it has, generally speaking, never been easy for artists to make a living. Mm-hmm. I mean, just the idea of combining the work that we do, the creative work that we do, with the world of commerce, it's not easy, and it's made even harder when people see them as, well, I will just make my art and sell it. Well, it's two very different things. You got to make your art and make a business.
Yeah.
Both of those things should be an act of creativity. And I think you and I have had a conversation along these lines as well, so I won't repeat it. But I do think, absolutely, I think there's room to make a living doing anything. Mm. I think really the question is not, can it be done? The idea is, how bad do you want it?
Mm.
And how willing are you to learn the tools of another craft? Because the ability to sell and the ability to speak to an audience and to market yourself, really all the same, they're different words for the same thing. That is an entirely different language and a different craft. And if you simply go in and say, well, I'm a photographer, I'll just put my website up and people will come. Mm. People will never just come. And the photographers that have made a commercial success of themselves, two things are true. There are really brilliant photographers who will never make a commercial success of themselves because they either don't have or they refuse to learn the business skills. And there are some excellent business people that are making money hand over fist. And frankly, their photography is, without being unkind, their photography is crap. Mm. And it's because, and that just speaks to the fact that you can truly sell anything to anyone. They're two completely different skill sets. So it's very important for the beginning photographer who wants to make the transition, just to remember that it's two different skill sets. It's also very important for the so-called professional to remember that just because they make money at what they do doesn't validate what they do. It doesn't put a stamp of approval on their work. And there are a lot of very enthusiastic amateurs, and I use the word with the utmost respect, people that love what they do, that need to hear that their work is not validated by making money at it, because that will give them permission to continue not to make money at it. Mm. Because there is always the possibility that you taint what you do when commercial concerns come up. You change the way you use your time. You change the people for whom you make your work. And eventually some of those voices, unless you're very conscious of it, some of those voices will change your direction. And 3 years from now, you look up and go, man, landscape photography was the love of my life, but I started taking wedding gigs to make ends meet. And now I don't have time to make landscape photography. Mm-hmm. I'm just an unhappy wedding photographer. You may be very good, but if it's not what you want to do, don't become good at something you don't want to do.
Mm. Yeah, that's an incredibly valid point. I mean, I've said one of the key things that I've really tried to do as I build my business out. I mean, we're in a few months we enter our fifth year of business. At the end of
that's
the,
exciting.
It is. One of the things that I really made a point not to do is to do work that I didn't want to do, and to build the business around work that I do want to do. And so it's like people often say, why don't you just sell prints, third party fulfilled prints, for example? And I could probably make a lot more money from print sales if I was to have them done on a third party, sell them a little bit cheaper, put them on a third party website. And I mean, I am thinking about this as an option, as one option, but part of the reason that I self-fulfill prints is because I like printing. You know, I enjoy the act of putting the roll paper into the printer, you know, just going through working on the image, soft proofing, and getting it looking great for the print, and then just watching it roll out of the printer. I enjoy the process. And there are other things that when I started this business that I said, you know, I was never going to work for an amount of money that I didn't feel happy receiving, you know. Mm. And I'm not necessarily saying that it's all about money, but if I accept a job for an amount that I feel is too low, I'm not going to put everything into that job. Or I'm going to make sure. I mean, obviously there are times when you have to do jobs for less money than you think you should be getting, but you need to then make sure that you're getting some other compensation that makes you feel good about doing the job. And I think that the moment people start to do, as you were saying, you're a landscape photographer, but then decides to start shooting weddings because to pay the bills. If you don't want to become a wedding photographer, then figure out how to do it with your landscape photography, because there are ways. It's just that you've got to figure out how to make what you love a business. And like you were saying, it takes a lot of skills and a lot of creativity to run a business as well as to actually make beautiful photographs.
Yeah, it does, and it takes it takes an understanding of what compromises you're willing to make. But you know, I guarantee you that I live in Vancouver, and you know, you're in Tokyo. There's it's a big. Both of them are for. I mean, Tokyo is huge compared to Vancouver. But you know, how many dentists, doctors, lawyers, professional offices have you ever walked in that there's no art hanging on the walls? What would it take? Now, I don't particularly want to do this kind of work at this point, but what would it take to get the list of, you know, top 100 of those types of offices and go in and make some acquaintances and see what their policy about buying art is and to make some relationships? I mean, it may be hard work, and people are probably listening going, man, I just don't have the patience. Well, that's fine, but someone else does have the patience, and they're the ones that are putting their art on those walls.
Yeah.
So there are markets. There are stock, as much as people do sort of decry the state of the stock market right now, I mean, stock photography. The fact is you can still make money and make a living. I don't make a living with stock photography, but I make a side income it's helpful and it's growing. And there are models of stock photography that don't force you into this, pennies a photograph compensation model. And there are lots of ways. Yes, it's getting harder, but all that means is things are changing, and the question is, how can you roll with those changes? I did a blog post at one point about, it was called Work or Wine. And it basically said, you can't change the situation. You can bitch about it all you like, but you cannot change it. So take the energy you're spending on whining, and pat yourself on the back, do what you need to kind of dry the tears, and then get to work. Like, figure out a way to adjust to the new market and whatever the new economy circumstances are forcing us into. Just whining about, and you wouldn't believe, as someone on a micro stock forum, you know, posted it, and some people thought it was great, and other people, you once in a while you see something on your blog that goes, oh, how did they get there? And then you find something on a forum, and the things people were saying about me, like, oh, this guy doesn't live in the real world. This guy's probably one of these guys. He's had a camera for 3 years and leads a workshop, and he thinks he doesn't know the wet dark room like I do. And I'm like, dude, I was mixing chemicals before you were, before you could even hold a camera, and some of this kind of vitriol that was filtering out. And I thought, there they are, they proved my point. They're on the forums bitching and whining instead of just figuring it out. Is it easy? Of course it's not. Is it hard and even heartbreaking to see a model that you've made a living at change and crumble? And especially when it's being done by short-sightedness and stupidity, I'm just shocked about the whole Getty thing right now, Getty making this vast library available to people for, for online editorial use and stuff. But we can spend our time bitching about it, or we can make a decision to either benefit from it or spend our energy just ignoring it and creating our art. I mean, we only have so much time in life. So if somebody steals your photograph, you can spend 7 weeks trying to pursue them for an invoice or calling your lawyers and suing them and whatever you want. Or you can, and it may be worth that to you, it may, but it may also be worth you going, all right, doesn't mean you're not going to rage about it. The red mist comes up, you need a glass of whiskey to kind of relax yourself and kind of, stop your fists from clenching. But then you realize, it was work I did 4 years ago. It's not my best work. And I could spend the next 7 weeks instead creating work that's really much better. And in the end, you're a happier individual. So it sort of comes down to this, old axiom. You can either be right or you can be happy.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more. It's there are so many things that are changing in the current market that, we both moved. I know that you also work with Offset now. And although it's not bringing in enough to I'm not going to retire on the proceeds from Offset. But I think that it's very cool that to be able to even make, some revenue from, work that I made out of passion for the work and not necessarily for, the work that I was doing, on assignment. It wasn't me running out trying to make work that I would be able to sell as stock photography. It's work that I would have done anyway, and being able to put that into onto an agency and then have them work to sell it for me. It all helps to pay the rent. And, I think that one of the big things that I've done over this last few years is just make sure that I don't depend on any one revenue stream. And I think that that's, you know, that if you build a business and you try to do one thing really good, then obviously if you can do it really good and you can get the niche, then at that point you maybe want to start thinking about cutting back on some of the other things that you've tried to do. But I think a lot of people these days find that a business really runs you're able to keep a roof over your head by doing a number of things and get revenue coming in from various places. And then if one of them goes away, it's not going to take you under.
Absolutely. That multiple income stream. And again, we've talked about it, so I won't rehash it, but it really is very important. And it's a beautiful thing to make one photograph and find four or five different revenue streams for it, you know, to put it in a book that you can sell, to put it into instructional material that you can sell, to print it and sell that, and then to have it at a stock agency that does respect your work. And no, maybe they're not getting thousands of dollars for it, but they're getting, you know, $100 for it, or getting you to a place where you're getting paid for your work in multiple areas. Yeah. And, you know, people will bitch and go, well, I don't want to sell my work for 10. It's worth more than $10. And my thinking is, well, yeah, but if you've got it in six different outlets, six different revenue streams, and they're all earning different amounts, especially if it's passive stuff that's selling over and over again, and something like, you know, an ebook or a, you know, a print sale is not really passive, but you know, you could print a dozen of them and have them ready to ship out or whatever. Then you have one photograph that's earning on multiple income streams, and that can be quite powerful, especially if you have 3,000 of those photographs all earning on multiple income streams. It does get you to a place where you go, you know what, this is manageable. And now I can, it gives you the, both the finances and the courage to go, you know what, I'm going to go do another personal project because the last work is paying for it. Now I'll go to Iceland or Namibia or someplace. Because a lot of people, I think they listen to your podcast. And I mean, the thing they really just, I mean, they would love it if they could afford to go to these places. Yeah. Maybe that's the thing that gets them there. And you and I have had long journeys to get to the point where we can do these things. But it's not like you and I, either of us have a bank account that we just, you know, we're not, neither of us are trust fund kids. Right. You know, we made our money on photography and now it self-sustains, but it was a long road getting there.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So I think there's a whole bunch of stuff in this conversation that people will be able to listen to and benefit from. So it really has been great speaking with you. And I think we're both at the point where, and obviously I'm not going to pretend that I'm anywhere near as far down the road as you are, but I think that I'm definitely at the point now where I'm starting to feel happy that things are going to go well. And there's always a bit of apprehension, I think, when you start a business. And I was perhaps, a little bit, too confident that things were going to go well. I mean, I'm confident in my abilities to work hard and to make stuff happen. And I think that really is probably one of my biggest strengths, in that just don't give up. I'm going to sidetrack myself a little bit here, but we were recently, obviously, we were doing my winter tours. And I managed to turn a what could have been a bad situation around with no sea ice for the Sea Eagles. I managed to turn that around with a bit of persistence and just a few long conversations and some negotiation. I managed to make what could have been a nasty situation really good for my participants. And I think that, and I know for a fact that there were other groups in the area that weren't so persistent, and they left the area without their photos. So I think that, you know, one of the biggest things that I'd like to add on to this is, if you are going to do if you're going to try to make photography into a business, just really be prepared to work really hard and make some tough decisions sometimes, but really be prepared to work really hard for your dream. But I think that the biggest thing that is flooding to the top as I talk about this with you here today, David, is that we're both doing stuff that we absolutely love doing, and being able to do that, and like you say, get to those places like Iceland, Namibia. I mean, you've traveled the world many times with your photography, and I think being able to do this. It's kind of like that old, what is it, I'm going to show my age here, the Dire Straits song, Money for Nothing.
Sure.
It's like, it's almost as good as being a guitarist in a band, and just, in fact, I'd say in many ways it's better, but.
Absolutely. I don't want to carry a guitar.
But yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, you do what you love, and a bit of persistence and a lot of hard work turns it into something that can sustain a family. And I think that for me, it being at this point where I'm kind of starting to come out of the woods, and I'm thinking that it's going to work. There's absolutely no regrets for myself in trying to do this the way I'm doing it. But yeah, I think that there's, realistically, people just have to understand that it is a lot of hard work. But once you have put that work in, well, you know what? I was going to say you get to a point where it gets easier, but it doesn't, because you still work hard. You're always going to be there's always the next job to do, or the next 50 jobs to do. And you just prioritize your time and keep hacking away at it. But because it's for something that you love doing, it doesn't feel that much like work. It's a brilliant way to make a living.
Yeah, it is. And I think, you know, you said it and then backtracked, it gets easier. You're right. It doesn't get easier, but it gets a little easier to trust that the harder you work, the greater the chances that things are actually going to work out.
Yeah.
And the only thing I would say is that, you know, for those that are listening that have no intention of doing this to make a living, you still have to work hard. You know, there's this talent myth that says that, you know, well, I'm not really as talented as this guy. And so, well, that's just nonsense. And the fact is, there are so few people that are actually, you know, these card carrying geniuses. The rest of us just have to figure it out and work hard at it. And even if you don't want to make this a living, it's not a question of talent. Everyone is creative in some fashion. Mm-hmm. If photography is your medium, now there are differently creative people and there are definitely differently talented people. Mm-hmm. And there are some photographers whose work just stuns me. Mm-hmm. But I would go on record saying that I bet most of them also work their asses off. Mm-hmm. And the ones that I most respect, I respect the work itself, the quality of the work. Inevitably, I find out that they have been doing this since they were a kid, or they've been doing it like Joey L since he was 16. But he has literally, made it his life, and his work ethic puts mine to shame. And I like to think I'm a pretty hardworking person. But no matter what, whether you do this as a living or not, whether you want to make a living or, you know, feed your family or feed your soul, you still have to work hard at it, because talent is not everything. Mm-hmm. I wish it was, and I wish I had more of it. But the fact is, the hard, it's kind of that question, you know, how hungry are you? How badly do you want it? Yeah. And travel's never easy. To get back to our initial conversation, landscape photography is not always easy. It's rarely easy, because the best stuff happens when the weather is garbage, when everyone else is packed up and gone home. There's a lot of uncertainty. You got to work hard for it. I don't know anywhere in the world that I've just stopped at one of those places that, you know, the tourist council says, stop here and make a picture. Mm-hmm. You know, photo stop ahead. I never stop at those places, because there's never anything worth seeing. And if there are, there's 300 people there that have made the same photograph at the same time of day. And the hard work is, you know, is taking your 4x4, bashing through the bush and finding something other people haven't, or putting up with the bugs or the weather or the uncertainty of, you know, or just being away from your family. I mean, if you travel, eventually you're going to be away from your family at some point. All of this stuff is hard, and it's too easy to give ourselves the excuse of, well, you know, I don't have enough money, I don't have enough talent, I don't have enough time. If you want it badly enough, you'll make it work. And talent is the worst possible excuse, because most of the people that look like they have talent, that look like they just do it so easily, they're working their asses off, and it took them a long time to get there.
Yeah,
incredible. That's my last sermon.
Well, it's so true, and I always feel as though I'm coming away from a conversation with you feeling richer for it. So I hope that the listeners also feel that way. I'm sure they do. We'll start.
Well, I do too. And if I can just, I just want to say something, Martin. I think, and you may have planned this, but you've been very modest about your book, and And I don't think we've even mentioned its title. So because you won't do it, I'm going to mention that others out there should look up Striking Landscape, which is your latest book. And I believe the subtitle, if I recall correct, is Techniques for Photographers in Beautiful Places. And it's got some beautiful work in it. And I want to say, Martin, I said it in my write-up about the book, you have an ability with technical stuff, especially in person, you know, in your workshops and that sort of thing. When I've been with you, you have a really an uncommon ability to explain technical stuff, and there can be a great deal of technical stuff with landscape stuff. So if you compare, you know, your book on landscapes and mine is all artsy fartsy poet warrior stuff, and yours gets into, you know, pano heads and a lot of the technical stuff. And I think it's an uncommon ability to sort of teach that stuff with the clarity you do. So for those that are listening, highly recommend that you listen, that you go to craftandvision.com and look at Martin's book, Striking Landscapes, because it is a great book and it's a killer value. And don't take my word at it because I'm just the publisher, but it really is a great book, Martin. And since you won't say it, I just want to, you know, again, congratulate you. Oh. It's brilliant.
Yeah, thanks very much. That's and you know what you were just saying there really again it resonates on something that we've touched on, but I think we play to our strengths, and I mean you do the artsy fartsy poet warrior into using your own words because you know obviously I wouldn't say that, but you know you do the art stuff just so well. I mean you talk about it in a way that few other people can, and so I think that, you know, we work with our strengths. I do the technical.
Absolutely.
And absolutely. And this is really.
Yeah, I think that doing the stuff that you said playing to your skills is important. And I think if you play to your skills, that's not only the stuff you're good at, it's usually the stuff that we enjoy the most. So my encouragement is always not to fight that and to find that the thing that we enjoy doing the most happens to be the thing that we're the best at.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the theme of the conversation today. I'll try and figure out a nice concise title related to that, because that's what we seem to have come back to. That's the theme for the conversation today. So really, thanks very much for your time today, David. It's been a pleasure as usual. And I hope that we get a chance to do this again before too long.
My pleasure. Thank you, Mark.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Ciao.
Okay, so that was a lot of fun, as usual. Remember that you can catch up with David over at davidduchemin.com and also check out his incredible video podcasts at craftandvision.com. And, of course, there's my new Craft and Vision ebook that David was kind enough to mention there. That's Striking Landscapes. That's also over on craftandvision.com, and you can get there with the short link directly to the product page with mbp.ac/CVSL for Craft and Vision Striking Landscapes, CVSL. So we'll wrap it up there, and I will be back, probably back to the Monday release schedule next week. But thanks very much for listening today. Remember that you can find me on Google+, Twitter and Facebook, and links to everything that I'm up to are at martinbaileyphotography.com, so do drop by and take a look. I'll be back next week with another episode. In the meantime, you take care and have a great week, whatever you're doing. Bye-bye.